Hello and welcome to an all new episode of Talking Fußball, the Aufstieg edition, your source for all things Bundesliga 2 and lower league football. Usually we'd be talking about how great it is that football is finally back in Germany's most exciting league. There'd be a lot of chat about transfers and debate about how things will pan out in the second half of the season. But sadly, we were once again reminded that all of those things really don't matter an awful lot in the larger scheme of things, as Hertha's president Kai Bernstein passed tragically at the young age of 43. My name is Nick Wiltang, and I'm delighted to welcome Mr. Matt Herman here on the lower league version of our show for the very first time. Well, Matt, first of all, I really wish I could have welcomed you in a much different setting, but man, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I mean, I don't want to present myself as some sort of, confidant, loved one, whatever, of Kai Bernstein. But it did definitely upset, disappoint, and sadden me to see him go in the way that he did and to go at the moment that he did. I'm sure we'll have plenty of time to talk about it. I'm sure that, you know, the subject of, you know, Hertha's draw at the weekend will come up and all that. But yeah, thanks for having me on. Thanks for letting me come on and talk about Bernstein a little bit.
Oh, delighted to. Alongside the two of us, there is our groundhopping and refereeing expert and St. Pauli fan supreme, Mike Krickemeyer. How are you doing over there in the second most beautiful Hanseatic city there in Germany, Mike?
I'm doing really good, apart from our position back at the table, or at the top of the table. We also did this great Hamburg steht auf thing on the weekend, so there was a crowd of about 100, 150,000 people, depending on who counted and who do you ask, who stood up against racism and fascism in Germany. And I'm really proud that the city and many, many other cities as well in Germany did that on the weekend. So I'm okay. But of course, there's still a long way to go.
I mean, following German news ever so slightly, weren't there just 10,000 farmers who got like shit overturned? Like loads of laws and decisions overturned because they basically threatened to, I don't know, spill a bit of cow shit literally in Berlin.
Yeah.
I mean, if 10,000 farmers can move the governments that much, how much can 100,000 people in Germany's second largest city do?
I think in Berlin it was even more than 300,000.
Oh, wow.
At least I read it in the news. So the bad thing is not every one of us has had a tractor with us. So maybe that would have been even more impressive, I'm sure.
300,000 tractors protesting racism? Yeah.
Yeah. It would definitely been louder then. There are videos of that, pictures, so you might take a look at Instagram, social media, and you will have quite a good view on that. And but again, it's easy in a city like Hamburg. It's probably very easy in a city like Berlin, but it's even more impressive if you do that in cities like Cottbus, Dresden, Chemnitz, yeah. And even there were not that many, but more than 1,000 people in every one of these little cities. And this is what still gives me hope.
Well, I would very much agree. Well, we'll be back in just a jiff with part one of our show. Right, here we go. It's part one of Talking Fußball, the Aufstieg edition. Well, on January 16th, Kai Bernstein, the man who'd been the president of Hertha BSC, didn't wake up that morning and he had passed away tragically in his sleep at the age of 43. Matt, you are the resident Hertha fan of the Talking Fußball family, and well, can you tell us a little bit about Bernstein's background and how he became Hertha president?
Okay, yeah, thanks for having me here. Yeah, I mean, Bernstein's background is varied. There's a lot of things in his past. He's principally a sort of a marketing and events company proprietor. The main thing that attracted a lot of attention about Bernstein when he sort of put his name forward as someone who would like to be president of Hertha was the fact that he was an ultra. Back in the late 90s, he was one of the founders of Harlequins, which is sort of the main ultras group that, you know, leads a lot of the sort of organized fan culture stuff that happens in the Ostkurve in the Olympiastadion. For a while, he was actually the capo of the Harlequins and of the Ostkurve in that respect. That's a long way in the past. I mean, he hasn't stood on a soapbox with his back to the game, you know, calling out which chant need to be spoken in a very long time. But that was a really good hook for his candidacy. A lot of the newspapers picked up on this. And that sort of, I think, both caused a little bit of misunderstanding about what kind of person he was, but also gave him a lot of credibility among fans. And that credibility and the particular moment that he was able to capitalize on that credibility was just sort of like a confluence of factors that like catapulted him from basically an unknown, or at least unknown to the wider Hertha public, to, you know, a pretty resounding winner in a presidential election just about a year and a half ago. I mean, you know, Werner Gegenbauer, who we'll probably talk about in a minute, had been president of Hertha for almost 15 years. The last several years of his reign, as we all know, were not very satisfying, not very successful. There was a lot of feeling that he needed to go. He did announce he would resign. And, you know, it looked for all the world like we were going to get another sort of political, corporate, culture, insider type. And, you know, shockingly, and to most Hertha fans, like frontline Hertha fans, satisfyingly, Bernstein was able to win the election, you know, about a year and a half ago, and sort of put the club on a completely different direction than it had been on in the, you know, the Wild West days of, you know, the last four or five seasons.
Well, I mean, what did set Bernstein apart from Gegenbauer then? I mean, you sort of highlighted a little bit about Bernstein's background there, but what sort of decisions did he make as president when he was elected?
Yeah, I mean, basically, and I'll try to do this as briefly as I can, but like everything about Bernstein and everything about Werner Gegenbauer are like almost direct opposites. I mean, Werner Gegenbauer is like the ultimate symbol of like sort of West Berlin, like corporate culture and corporate like insiderism. He was the son of a building like cleaning company who grew that company, who got into like facilities management and security and basically like all these sort of B2B businesses where like, I don't know that Werner Gegenbauer like spent a lot of time with a lot of regular people in his whole life, you know? I mean, he was basically sort of cloistered in this like, you know, Vesey business world. And like Kai Bernstein is from Dresden and then lived in Marzahn as a teenager and young person. And
Marzahn is pretty fucking rough, we have to mention.
It is. It is. It's a very working class East Berlin neighborhood. And interestingly, and today, I think a lot of, you know, people from the former East Berlin do identify with Union and see it as sort of an East Berlin thing, you know, never mind the fact that it's really a Southeast Berlin thing and not all of East Berlin, but whatever. Kai Bernstein's history, becoming a Hertha fan in the 90s when, you know, after the wall came down, becoming an active ultra supporter as someone who grew up in East Germany, he symbolizes a lot of that sort of ambition that Hertha had in the immediate sort of, you know, Wende, post-Wende time, where like, you know, Hertha wanted to be the club of all Berlin. And Bernstein is very much symbolic of that. Bernstein was like, you know, he was a electrician and like industrial mechanic. He then went into like, you know, working in radio. He worked for Radio Energie. And like did a lot of events for them, founded his own events company. He's always out there with the people, always working on sort of like, you know, customer and fan experience. His entire sort of mindset is about sort of creating experiences for regular people to go to events and enjoy themselves. You know, his whole like mindset is completely different from Werner Gegenbauer. And he's also about 30 years younger. So it was an unbelievable like breath of fresh air when he came into this club. He basically said, we're going to take this club back to its roots. We're going to sell Döner in the Olympiastadion, which is, sounds like a totally simple and like, duh thing. But like, you know, they hadn't done it up until then. And Berlin is like the Döner capital of Germany, if not the world. Sorry, Turkey. But it's very, very simple things that sort of appeal to regular fans. They had a really successful sort of fan fest the period right before the first season in which he was in charge, where he was there and really making direct contact with fans, something that Gegenbauer never really showed a lot of interest in, and fans never showed a lot of interest in him. Whereas Kai Bernstein, like, I'm part of a North American Hertha fan group, not really an active part, but I am pay attention to the group chat in a while. And like one of the people in that group chat is like, yeah, I ran into Bernstein like taking a piss at the Olympiastadion and got into a conversation with him about how things were going at the club. And Bernstein was like, I want to hear about these fans in North America. What do you, are there a lot of fans? What do you guys need? He's a super open guy, even when he's holding his dick, pissing into a urinal. Like, he is open to the public, let's just say.
Well, quite so, yeah.
It felt like a 180-degree turn in this club when he took over, and I'm absolutely gutted that he's no longer with us, not only as a person, but as a symbol of this club.
I mean, one of the things that struck me during Gegenbauer's time, and compare that to now, was the fact that club and the team on the pitch had sort of gotten into a feud with a lot of the fan groups. I mean, there was a lot of bad blood between the fans and the team. I mean, Hertha's player refusing to go down to, you know, the stands, thanking those supporters for their support and all that. And with Bernstein, there was sort of a significant shift in that regard, wasn't there?
Yeah. I think there was a general sense, certainly in the last couple of years, in the sort of Windhorst, you know, the transition from Michael Preetz to Freddy Bobic, you know, there was a period there where fans believed that the club leadership was either asleep at the wheel or was like actively doing dumb stuff that was messing up the club. And that, you know, they wanted to throw as many tantrums as they could to sort of make those people in positions of responsibility understand that they were upset. I mean, to a great degree, I thought the fans were like totally unjustified in some of the stuff that they did. Like when you go to practice and you make veiled threats against players who basically have very little say in a lot of these sort of high level decisions, they just play football. That's a really terrible thing to do. That's, you know, unjustified in almost every instance.
It's dumb as fuck as well.
Oh my God.
I mean, do you want those guys to perform? Do you think they perform better if you threaten them?
Yeah, but there was a sense, and I think this was a not unjustified sense, that the club leadership and to a lesser degree, the playing staff, the technical staff, did not feel particularly responsive or beholden to the fans. They took the fans a little bit for granted, or they, you know, got the sense that like, we're just working our way towards something here. Guys, just be patient. And, you know, I think that's an attitude that you can cultivate within a club if your fans think that you're acting in good faith. But I think they rightly thought maybe they weren't acting in good faith for a while there.
Mike, I mean, you sort of observe a lot of the fan scenes outside of St. Pauli's fan scene as well. Have you spotted a change in the fan scene of Hertha ever since Bernstein has become the president of the club?
Boy, that's difficult to judge, especially from outside. But I think what Matt said was this change of 180 degree in the sense of the club. And I think this was definitely something that was also recognized outside of Berlin. And from the fans, at least I can say when St. Pauli played in Berlin this year, we did not had any problems. And this was also different in the past. So it was much more dangerous for St. Pauli fans to go there. But on the other side, this year we were 20,000. So maybe that was one of the reasons why it was not that difficult or dangerous for us. Yeah, but I think the main important thing is that he really gave a different view for all the other non-Hertha fans at the club, because he was one where I think Hertha in the past was not a club that you would judge as supporters-friendly, open-minded for new things and so on. And this totally changed with him. And I think also the reactions that were shown by the different fan scenes all over Germany on the last weekend showed that a lot. So I do not remember so many banners or whatever for Franz Beckenbauer in the last couple of weeks. Of course, there were some things for his remembrance and so on, but this was mainly done by the clubs. And from a fan scene perspective, there was much more active involvement by the fan scenes for Kai Bernstein, from my point of view at least. And I think this also says a lot.
I mean, he's the sort of guy who said, you know what, we need to talk about pyrotechnics and we need to make them legal. And he meant it. I mean, you just bought it when he said it. And whenever somebody else from any other clubs comes out after years and years of not supporting it, you sort of think, why do they need the support of the active fan scene right about now? What's about to happen? Well, one thing, and Matt, you mentioned last Windhorst there. last Vintost had his thing, which was called the Big City Club. Kai Bernstein preferred Der Berliner Weg, as he called it. What did that entail?
Yeah, and I think that's probably, and it's really remains to be seen exactly what direction things are going to go in the coming months and years. But what I think we are likely to see is a continuation of this Berliner Weg. You know, the Berlin way, it's basically, it's a statement of self-confidence, I think, in most basic terms. It's basically saying, like, you know, we don't need to bring in a ton of, you know, outside know-how, a lot of outside players, a lot of outside sort of, you know, high-level corporate or high-level big city know-how to succeed. I mean, you know, on the playing side, it generally means that we're going to use a lot more youth players. We're going to put a lot more energy and, you know, effort towards bringing players in from the youth side and sort of integrating them into the professional staff, which has been, oh my God, such a sore spot for this club for such a long time. I mean, this is, you know, not necessarily the best academy in Germany, but it's up there. It's probably one of the more productive academies when it comes to sort of putting out, you know, high-level pros. However, you know, it seems like players very often can't find the right moment to be integrated into the first team squad, or if they do, they end up leaving quickly. And basically, this is a sort of a statement of purpose that we want to have more homegrown players playing. Beyond that, I think it's also, it's something that's sort of embodied in Bernstein himself. I mean, he is somebody who has been part of the Hertha fan scene for a really long time and didn't have a hugely impressive sort of managerial or corporate resume going into this job. I mean, he had a pretty successful independent events management company, marketing group, but basically he was a small business owner. And so there was a lot of, you know, in the election time saying like, oh, we can't trust such a big club or a big organization to somebody who's never run anything as big as this. And in a lot of ways, the Berliner Weg is just saying like, no, we can do this ourselves. And the fans, I feel like not just Hertha fans, but as you said, Mike, fans everywhere have responded to this, that like, we don't need this sort of extra layer of like sort of corporate gloss put over our football clubs. We can actually do this stuff ourselves. And the notion that that could work and that that could bring a club forward is hugely inspiring. I don't know if it's going to work. I mean, you know, we're kind of mid-table right now and, you know, who knows what the coming years will bring, but like, just the idea that we can do this ourselves is something that I think a lot of fans respond very positively to.
I mean, talking about doing it yourselves, it might be worth reminding ourselves what sort of mess Bernstein inherited when he took over, because it was a pretty huge one, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, this is the big asterisk in Let's Do It Ourselves. Let's do it ourselves with the help of several hundred million euros from 777 Partners, an extremely shady investment group from Miami. Yeah, big, big problems. I mean, Lars Windhorst and all the decisions that were made regarding outlays of cash on players, on, you know, extra administrative staff, that all added up and added up to a pretty bad situation. I don't think that Bernstein and his, you know, colleagues were all that jazzed about the idea of selling a big stake in the club to 777 Partners, who own, you know, a bunch of other clubs, including, you know, Sevilla, partially Everton. They're trying to make that deal go through, a number of other clubs. And who knows where Hertha is going to end up in the pecking order in that group. But they did see it as the only way out of the problem that they had gotten into via the Windhorst investment. Even beyond that, I think that there was, you know, other decisions that were made, not only the sale to 777, but, you know, bringing in Crazy Buzzer, their frankly horrific kit sponsor this season, which is, you know, a fly-by-night, like, casino game website in Germany. It's just, it's a bottom feeder sponsor.
Which is very interesting, though, because Bernstein, when he was appointed president, said that, you know, we won't take money from the gambling industry. So he certainly picked up on the job that once you are in the Bundesliga 2, you beggars can't be choosers.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting. Like, I think that when that decision was made to bring in Crazy Buzzer, there was a lot of people upset about that, rightly so. And I think the way that he handled that, I think, won him some friends. He basically said, like, you know what? The debts were worse than I thought. The market for our kit sponsorship was not as good as I thought. I don't like this particularly. We did it anyway. We're only going to do it for this 1 year, we hope. You know, I'm not sure how the folks at Crazy Buzzer felt about him saying that, that I don't particularly like this, or we only want to do this for 1 year. But, you know, good on him for saying it. And the checks have cleared thus far. Hopefully it'll be off the shirt as soon as possible.
Let's hope so. Well, one last question, guys. What legacy is Bernstein leaving behind, and how is the club going to fare without him now?
I think the legacy might be one thing that Matt has just touched. So in the past, also at St. Pauli, when fans got into the board or in higher positions in the club, there was always this little thing like, okay, it's just a fan. Can he really do it? Can she really do it? No, she's just a fan. And I think this has changed in the last couple of years a little bit, because, for example, at St. Pauli, there were some fans in important positions, some female fans in important positions. We now do have a president, which was a fan and, of course, still is a fan. And with Kai Bernstein, he took over one of the bigger clubs in Germany. And although it was a difficult situation, for example, this 777 deal, he explained it very, very open why it was the only way for Hertha. And I think everyone believed him when he said that, that it was the only way to do it. And I think this kind of communication of being honest and trying to do the right thing in a very, very dirty business, I think this might be one of the things that he could leave as a legacy.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. And not to go back to another sad episode in Hertha's recent history, but I remember one of the points that was brought up in the infamous Klinsmann dossier. Jürgen Klinsmann, the short-lived coach of Hertha, who, you know, basically left on a dime back in, I don't know, what, 2020, 21? I don't even remember at this point. One of the things that he mentioned, and I think he got right in that assessment of what was wrong with the club, is that there was a culture of sort of secrecy, of suspicion, of, you know, closed-mindedness, closed-offness between the club and the public, or between different parts of the club. I would like to think that one of the things that Kai Bernstein brought in was not only that sense of self-confidence, but a sense that, like, we can actually just do our jobs as well as we can in the most open way that we can, and, you know, let the consequences be the consequences. I feel like this was a club that was sort of, you know, to use a German word, verkrampft for just years, decades, by a sense that, like, you know, oh, we kind of have to hold on to what we have. We don't want to fall too far, and we got to do everything kind of just this certain way. And I feel like there's just a greater freedom to operate under the kind of club culture that Bernstein was able to bring in. I have no idea whether his successor, whoever that will turn out to be on a permanent basis, is going to be able to sort of cultivate that, or if they're going to want to cultivate that. But I would love it if they did, because, you know, it's a club that really, as you said, Mike, is one of the biggest clubs in Germany. It's, you know, got a huge fan base. It's got a stadium that's a little bit too big for it. We're working on that. But it's still a club that has tons of potential and tons of history, tons of ability to bring a lot of joy to a lot of people. And, you know, if Bernstein, with his fairly brief tenure, was able to sort of lay some seeds, some groundwork for that, I think he will have a great legacy.
I mean, one of the things that I've spotted this season is actually that even though Dardai and the lads in blue and white did really have a very poor start to the season, you never felt like the club stopped believing in Dardai or what they were about to do. They sort of knew that, you know, we just got relegated and we need some time to bed in. I mean, these things take time. Look at Bremen, look at Schalke, look at how they started. I mean, Bremen in particular, a couple of seasons ago when they were relegated. You know, they didn't know that they were going to get relegated before the last match day of the season. So they needed to switch things around ever so quickly, selling loads of players, getting loads of players in. And I mean, to bat all of those things in and make all the pieces of the puzzle fit is difficult. And I think Hertha in the past would probably have given Dardai the boot. I mean, under the old regime, if that what would have been the case, if that regime was still in place and they were in the situation that they've been in this season, but not the current regime. And I think that bodes well for the future in terms of allowing sporting development to happen rather than trying to force it.
Yeah. Yeah. You felt like the discourse in the early part of the season was a lot about the fact that they, you know, got off to a fairly early start vis-a-vis the transfer window and the squad was still sort of in a great deal of flux. And I feel like at a lot of points in time at a lot of clubs, those things feel like excuses. Those things feel like sort of an explanation for poor planning. But under the circumstances, in retrospect, those were not excuses. These were good explanations. They made largely good moves. They got rid of a lot of players they didn't need anymore, and they brought in a number of players who have helped. And I feel fairly confident that this is a club moving in a good direction. I don't yet have a lot of confidence that this is the year for them to go right back up. But I wouldn't be shocked if that happened, especially if, you know, they could get a piece of a certain club in red in the relegation playoff. Wouldn't that be fun?
Ooh, that would be nice. Anyways, just, you know, just wait. HSV will have their drop-off towards the end of the season, and then you boys in blue and white need to be ready. Anyways, changing to the other team from the lovely city of Hamburg, St. Pauli. Now, Mike, we've touched upon this before, but we need to talk about it once again, because there is a conflict going on. Mike, can you explain why there is a disagreement between the German and the international fan scene at the moment? Just to remind our listeners.
Yeah, well, like you said, we touched that, but it's still a very, very difficult topic. And for me, especially because as a German person to explain this conflict in an international podcast, it's quite challenging. So I try to keep it simple, short, and will also try to explain it as neutral as possible, because, of course, there are so many emotions going on and so on. So directly after this terroristic and horrific attacks from the Hamas on the 7th of October, FC St. Pauli issued a statement, the club, in which they announced their solidarity with Israel and the Jewish people. Full stop. In reply to that, many international fan clubs announced a statement demanding the club to also show some solidarity with the people in Gaza. Well, fair enough, to be honest, but maybe not the best point in time to do so. From that moment on, from my point of view, the damage was done. So it's a very old conflict in the political left, especially in Germany. Some people defend Israel and everything they do. Some people criticize the politics of Israel, especially for what they do with Palestine. And of course, there are also some wise people who do a fine way to accept the right of Israel to defend itself, but also criticize their actions. So somehow in this whole story, it became an us against them conflict from both sides. And many international fan clubs decided that they can't continue to support St. Pauli as they don't feel welcome anymore. And they think the club and the supporter from Germany are standing on the wrong side. And yeah, that's more or less is everything I can say on that. But like I said in the beginning, it's really difficult.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's been a conflict for years, this, because I think once in the past, a few years back, there was a Spanish, I think, reggae song played on the stereo of the Milan Tour, which, you know, intellectually, supporters of St. Pauli, they do know their foreign languages, and some of them were shocked to find that this Spanish reggae song included support for Palestine and a free Palestinian state, and that song was then criticized. They criticized the club for playing that song in the halftime break or whenever that was. So it's sort of like this thing goes way back. And I mean, it's sort of like from an outside point of view, it's actually kind of strange to see that people on the left in Germany are that supportive of Israel, because wherever you go elsewhere in Europe, the left tends to support the Palestinian fight for independence. But I mean, there are good historic reasons for that. And, you know, if you don't know why, you know, pick up a book. Anyways, moving on from that digression. Now, a little over a week ago, the Glasgow branch of St. Pauli's international fan clubs decided to cut their ties to the club. Now, this fan club has had a very special place in many St. Pauli fans' hearts. Can you tell us why that is?
Well, to be honest, I like them a lot. And the main reason, of course, is the strong connection between St. Pauli and Glasgow Celtic in general. So over the years, many, many personal relationships and friendships have been built on that. And in addition, they also did a really great job in their local community, like many other St. Pauli international fan clubs as well. They did many, many charity activities, and this was always connected to the name of FC St. Pauli. And the latest big action was the Love Glasgow Hate Racism concert, including The Wakes and many other bands. And this was the reason why this especially was quite hard to see, that this band now breaks apart. And on a personal note, I'm really sorry for that, but maybe there was no other way.
Yeah, you don't see St. Pauli changing its stances somewhat or moderating, you know, both fan clubs and, you know, the club itself.
I don't think so. I don't see a way how this will, how this will change in the near future. So St. Pauli needs to make this clear statement to support the right of Israel to defend itself. This is something that is expected in Germany from the political left. And there were also some statements in that international statement, which was, from a German point of view, needs to be seen as anti-Semitic. And from my point of view, that there is no way back. So that there will be, of course, personal friendships that will probably survive that. Some international fan clubs are also continuing their work, same as before, doing screenings of the games and so on. But the ones who announced their ending were also hugely disappointed by the missing support from other fan clubs and the fan club council. And I don't see a way to heal those wounds. And some people might continue to support St. Pauli individually, but that big community won't be the same anymore. And I think, like I said, this is really sad. But on the other hand, it's the way it is. And maybe it's even better that way, because some conflicts have always been there, but were ignored from both sides.
Well, there you go. One last topic we can pick up. And, well, she isn't here, but we need to mention her, Jasmine. She asked me to have a drink on this podcast, so I did oblige that wish, and I'm having a beer from my local brewery, Zalikat. But one thing that Jasmine always mentions, or, you know, tends to mention in passing whenever we sort of get towards the Rückrunde section of the season, is that there's a bit of a curse on the teams who end up being Herbstmeister in the Bundesliga 2. So listen to that. Out of the last seven teams who finished top after the Hinrunde and went into the winter break as the Herbstmeister, out of the last seven teams, only two got promoted. Those two teams are Darmstadt, who are currently really struggling in the Bundesliga, set to go back down, and Arminia Bielefeld, who managed to get up into the Bundesliga in the 2019-20 season. Now they're in the Dritte Liga, only 4 years later on. So Holstein Kiel, they were crowned this season's Herbstmeisters. They started their Rückrunde with a 2-1 loss against relegation fodder candidates Eintracht Braunschweig. Question is the curse of der Herbstmeister going to strike once again?
Well, it looks like, because if you have seen the game, it started so great for Holstein Kiel with that goal from Steven Skripski after 11 minutes, after a corner for Braunschweig. He scored from the middle line in a counterattack. And how could a game start better for you? So table leaders playing against a team from bottom of the table at home. If you screw this up, it does something to your mind. So especially if both teams behind you win their games after that on the weekend. So it was just one game, but they need to recover from that.
And Matt, you're sitting there as a hurt of fan thinking, chances here.
Maybe. Like I said, I still don't have a hell of a lot of confidence that Hertha are really part of the promotion chase. I mean, they're 8 points off the playoff spot.
Bremen had a bigger deficit, didn't they?
Yeah, keep talking them up, Nick. Let's do that. No, I think at the very least, it's going to be a long shot for Kiel to hang on to an automatic promotion spot. I mean, they're in a cluster of, I guess, the top five teams who are within 5 points of each other. I mean, it's anybody's game among those. And, you know, somebody's going to be left out, and it might as well be Kiel.
Well, there you go. Well, you mentioned that cluster of teams there. Well, looking at those teams a little bit more closely, HSV always in turmoil, even though they got off to a great start winning their match on the weekend. St. Pauli, they're missing their two Australian guys because they're competing in the Asian Cup. I mean, things might really heat up in the coming weeks, and this five-horse race might even turn into a six- or seven-side race. Or, Mike, do you think that there's one team that does have a bit of an edge over all its competitors, or maybe even two?
Well, I could say St. Pauli, of course, but I'm not sure if I really believe in that. So you might ask me after the next two games, or the next league and the next cup game, because both of them, from St. Pauli point of view, will be against Fortuna Düsseldorf. And if we, well, at least manage a draw on the weekend and then win in the cup just 4 days later on Tuesday at home, I think we would be, on such an euphoria wave to just surf on it until the end of the season. But if we lose on Saturday, if we are thrown out of the cup on Tuesday, well, everything could change. And I think this is, of course, all our listeners expect us to just make a statement here and say, okay, I know how this season will end and this is it. But we can't. We're talking about the Zweite Bundesliga. It's always a miracle. You don't know what to expect. And this is the same every single season. And I think it's the same in here. So I don't see one team at the moment. If it should be one team, I would go with St. Pauli, because we have been so stable the whole season and we have no loss still. But again, it might change in the next couple of days.
Fingers crossed. Well, this is it for part one of the show. We'll be back in a jiff with part two. Right, here we go. It's part two of Talking Fußball, the Aufstieg edition. And, well, let's do a little bit more housekeeping then. A little while ago, we chatted about KFC Uerdingen. KFC actually stands for Krefelder FC. It's got nothing to do with, you know, tortured animals. Well, KFC Uerdingen, they're once again being in financial trouble. The club has been on a bit of a roller coaster ride ever since its Bundesliga days back in the 90s, back when they were, you know, known as Bayer Leverkusen. Now they're once again in the fifth division, and a few months ago we talked a little about them because they had just found a new main sponsor, a company by the name of DASBOB, which was supposed to become the next German Amazon whilst being sustainable, introducing its own NTFs as a payment method, and we were like, great, but what are they supposed to be selling and how they're supposed to be making money? Even back then, there were doubts about if that company actually could pay the amount they agreed to pay KFC Uerdingen. Well, it turns out they couldn't. So, in order to get into bet with that company, KFC made the very poor decision of kicking out its former main sponsors out the door, and they signed a deal with a company that couldn't pay the amount they agreed upon. So, how have things been going since we last left off then, Mike?
Yeah, first of all, I'm still deeply, deeply sorry that Kentucky Fried Chicken did not make any attempt to be main sponsor of Uerdingen. I don't know why. It would be so easy for them, and yeah, they could just save them for the next couple of years. Okay.
Yeah, but Getafe, sponsored by Burger King back in the day.
Oh yeah, Pizza Hut with Fulham. I mean, there's a rich tradition of fast food sponsors.
Doritos.
Wolves,
yeah.
But they are part of the name. Mm-hmm. So all this RB Leipzig thing trying to not be Red Bull, it would be so easy for them. So I get that. Okay, but in the end, they are still struggling. They desperately need those 500,000 euros to be able to play until the end of the season. Some players left the club in winter break. They only have 21 players left at the moment in the squad. And they do have a counter on their website. So I took a look at it yesterday in the afternoon. It was been 140,000 until now. So you can do the math. It's still 360,000 missing. And that's still a huge gap, and I don't really see a way for them to achieve that unless some big sponsors steps in. So hi KFC again. On the other hand, if they need to file for insolvency again, that's not necessarily the end of it all, because they just receive a deduction of 9 points, and being in fourth place at the moment, 16 points clear of relegation spots, they could start in the Oberliga again next season anyhow.
Well, yeah, right. You mentioned that they have started to collect stuff. I mean, the last article that was updated I found was from, I think, January 2nd, and it said that they had collected over 100,000 euros at that point. So the next couple of weeks, they only collected another 40,000 euros. So that doesn't bode well in terms of the speed that they're going in terms of, you know, getting that money into the coffers of the clubs. Anyways, now, main question is, what sort of lessons should the club draw from this very experiment?
I don't know. Maybe don't ever trust a Russian oligarch once again. Maybe that's lesson one.
Or foul-mouthed German upstart inventor.
Yeah, maybe that's also. I don't know. On one hand, it's a big club with a big history and so on, but they don't seem to get it straight. And that's really challenging. And of course, if you start going down the leagues, if you end up in the Oberliga, that's not financial paradise. So you can't earn money in that league, and maybe you need to accept that.
True. Well, you're talking about them playing in the Oberliga. One piece of good news they had was actually the fact that the Grotenburg, the stadium they're playing at, they're able to open all stands of that ground now. Now the stadium is back at a capacity of 10,000 spectators. Mike, you are the ground hopping expert here. Can you tell us anything about the Grotenburg?
Well, first of all, I do like their mascot more than their stadium, which is the famous Grotifant, an elephant dressed in their shirt. But of course, there's a decent smell of history in that stadium. Like I said, remember during the good old days with European Cup and so on. Yeah, well, the game where they first are allowed to bring in 10,000 people again is against SC St. Tönnies.
Mm.
Even I never heard of them. And they are not allowed to open all stands, but they are allowed to open the two main stands at least, including some terraces. And before winter break, just 2,500 were allowed. So now it's 10,000. But in the Oberliga, you don't even get 2,500 people into a stadium. So I don't see how they could bring in 10,000. So if I understand correctly, the supporters block directly behind the goal remains closed. And I really doubt that there will be that many people there for this game, especially.
Well, I mean, if St. Tönnies doesn't get them through the gates, who will? I mean, one thought that just struck me. If you had to answer this question really quickly, which is the biggest fuck-up side from West Germany ever? Is it Oerdingen or is it Wattenscheid?
I would go for Aachen.
Oh, the Joker. Nice. Well, can you give us a reason for why you actually chose Aachen?
Yeah, because they played the cup final, they played in European Cup, they built a new stadium, and they are also in the Regionalliga now. So they screwed it up with that new stadium. And it's, of course, yeah, it's easy to say that afterwards, that they made everything wrong. But they built a stadium for first league, and they didn't even manage to stay in the second league. And this, of course, was financial suicide.
True, very much so indeed. Talking about financial suicide, MSV Duisburg are shaking things up. Well, the Dritte Liga kicked back into action this weekend. Duisburg, they were really at the bottom end of the table, and they are desperately, desperately trying to change things around. Didn't really happen for them on the weekend, as they lost 4-1 against TSV 1860 München, another side struggling, another traditional big club struggling. Now, one of the things that they have done at the club, you know, whilst hitting panic station is, first of all, changing the coaches towards the end of the Hinrunde. Boris Schommer is now taking place there. And now they've brought in a couple of new players there, both of them with a lot of experience. Mike, in your experience, do you think that them bringing in old players who are looking for one last paycheck, like Daniel Ginczek, who really doesn't cut it anymore in the Zweite Liga for Fortuna Düsseldorf, is the way out of the current situation?
I do love Daniel Ginczek. He was a great player at St. Pauli. And if someone can do it, he's the guy. Yeah, you might hear it. I don't really believe in that. It's only 5 points, so that's the good thing. But there's not that much hope in Meiderich at the moment, I think. I just got the news that their captain, Sebastian May, torn his ACL. So this is also added on bad news. And from that point of view, well, hope dies last, but it will be challenging days for them, and weeks and months.
Can you give us a quick download on why this big team is entangled in the relegation dogfight at all? I mean, they are a huge club. Huge. I mean, they were among the founding members of the Bundesliga in 1963.
Yeah, and they played well in some years. They played in Europe some years. They have been to the cup final 4 times, I think. So, yeah, they've been great in the past, but it's a similar story like Aachen, Wattenscheid and Uerdingen. They did not manage in a good way to deal with the money. They also build a new stadium and maybe, yeah, it's challenging. If you are not a constant member of first or second league, you will always try to get back and you need to have a fair amount of luck, not only money, but also luck. And they probably did not have that. And yeah, they could be in the Regionalliga next season, I think.
Damn, the Regionalliga West will be fun then. Of the lower divisions below the Bundesliga 2, it's my favorite one actually. But anyways, you know, I've already told you that Boris Schommer has taken over as a coach there to Duisburg. But on top of all of those things, I mean, Ginczek coming in, Ahmed Engin, a former player of theirs, coming in from NFC Volos. On top of those two, three things that have happened of late, another huge development took place during the winter when they decided to hire a new head of business. And, well, he is a former player, and his name is Michael Preetz.
Bum.
Matt.
Bum.
You know the guy fairly well. You know, I remember us talking about him like a decade ago, and many, many more times after that. What can Duisburg fans expect from the new main guy in charge?
I think that they can expect some good things, along with some things that they're probably not going to really like. I mean, he is very professional. He was at Hertha for, you know, almost 15 years, doing various sporting director adjacent or sporting director head things. And he got a lot of things right on the sort of mid to lower end of the transfer market. Like, he's not bad at finding sort of undervalued assets and, you know, selling people for a little bit more than what he bought them for. He's not very good at choosing coaches. I think almost all the coaches he chose ended up not working out, and the ones that he either inherited or sort of put in on an interim basis ended up being better.
What, you say Michael Skipper didn't work out for you guys? Oh, come on.
Oh, yeah. Friedhelm Funkel, ooh. Otto Rehhagel.
Let's see the history of German football.
The list goes on and on. Yeah, he's not very good at the public-facing aspect of the job. He's not a very charismatic or sort of vocal, like inspirational guy. But he's been in the business a really long time. He knows a lot of people. He knows a lot of agents. I'm sure that if this is a club that's looking to sort of, you know, make some big changes, and if you're second bottom in the third division, I think that's what you're doing. I think he could bring some good things. I mean, it's not, I think, all that usual for a club of this stature. And I don't mean historical stature, but I mean like where they are in the table, you know, way down in the third division, for them to attract somebody who has that much experience in the top flight level. So I feel like it's possible this might do something good for them. I personally did not really enjoy the Preetz era at Hertha so much, so I'll leave it at that.
Well, it was topsy-turvy. I mean, once he got that Winterhouse cash, he really lost his way. I mean, to be fair, I mean, he's not a guy who does particularly well with a lot of cash on his hands.
Yeah, he won't have that problem at MSV.
I'm sure he won't. Anyways, this is it for another edition of Talking Foosball, the Aufstieg edition. This one has been produced by Aiden Reintool, as always, our all-star producer. Guys, really blast chatting to the two of you. Well, two of you, tell our listeners where they can find you on X, or formerly known as Twitter, and all other social media. Matt, I'm going to start with you.
Sure. You'll find me at Mr. Matt Herman. I haven't posted in forever because Twitter, X, kind of a depressing place these days. But, you know, I'm there. If you want to reach out, I'll say, hey, well, let's chat.
Right, Mike then.
Not on X, not on Twitter anymore, or just with a dead account, but you can follow the Milan Tone on Blue Sky, Mastodon, Threads, Facebook, Instagram, and of course in the blog itself.
That is great. You can follow me on Twitter as well at NoMusings. You can follow the podcast at Talking Foosball. Make sure to leave us an iTunes rating or maybe even a review if you want to really make us happy. Go to our Patreon site, patreon.com/talkingfoosball, if you want to dive into loads and loads of historic German football content. And with that, it is goodbye for now. See you again next week.